Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. My name's Roland Raja. I'm the director of the Lowe Institute's International Economy Program. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to be hosting this evening's In Conversation with Professor Hal Varian. Hal is Google's chief economist and a highly distinguished professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Varian literally wrote the textbook that taught my generation of economists, so it really is a tremendous pleasure to be with you here today. How the evening will go is that I'm going to take the liberty over the next 20 to 25 minutes to ask Professor Varian a series of questions, and then at the end we'll open it up for Q&A with the audience. So welcome, Professor Varian. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So why don't we start by, why don't you tell us a little bit about what exactly does a chief economist of a company like Google do exactly?
Well, I'll tell you how I got there. I was a dean at Berkeley. And if you can stay out of trouble for 7 years, they give you time off for good behavior. So when I stepped down from being dean, I thought it would be interesting to do something outside of academia. I'd been doing a lot of work on technology and economics at that point. I bumped into Eric Schmidt, who said, I just joined this cute little company down in the South Bay. We've got about 300 people. Why don't you come down and give us a hand? So I went there in May of 2002 and worked on some problems, some issues, and some designs of systems that Google was implementing, and had a great time. When the year ended, I continued to consult for a few years, and then finally I shifted over full-time to Google. So what do I do there? Well, originally I did a lot of work on analytics using econometrics, statistics, operations research, trying to measure how well Google's systems were performing. We did a lot of market design. Many of you may know that Google's business model uses an auction for selling ads. Worked a lot on that. After the ad auction, there was an IPO auction, a patent auction, spectrum auction, top-level domain name auction, and I worked on all of those projects as well. Now, during the last few years, I've mostly been working on policy issues, competition policy, intellectual property, copyright, privacy, those sorts of things. So there's quite a bit for economists to do. And I will say one thing that's interesting is many other Silicon Valley companies have adopted chief economists. There's a chief economist at Microsoft, at Facebook, at Amazon, and a number of other high-tech companies.
Well, good to know that economists are in demand, so to speak.
Yes.
So turning to the substance, I'd like to just start at the top and ask you to give us, you know, a bit of a primer on why people say that data is the new oil, and why is the economics of data different to the economics of basically most other things? Why do we need to think about it differently?
Right. So I hear this statement a lot: data is the new oil. I would say they're alike in one respect. Both of them have to be refined before they're useful, because raw oil, not such a good Christmas gift, and same thing with raw data. If I gave you a bunch of raw data, you wouldn't know what to do with it. It's really the process of analyzing that data, organizing that data, producing information, using that information to produce knowledge, using that knowledge to produce understanding. That's the process that's necessary to really utilize data effectively. So there's a lot of discussion about data, but really it's the analytics that go into that data that matter. Now, of course, I told you I was doing data analysis all those years, so of course I think it's important and critical to how organizations function.
And so how does an economy where data is sort of king and it's the glue that's keeping the economy going, how does an economy driven by data and technology firms, how is that going to work differently to how we normally think of, say, the bricks and mortar economy, so to speak?
So that's a very important question. When you look at data, data is what economists call non-rival. If I have a barrel of oil and I give it to you, I have one less, you have one more. But if I have some data and I give it to you, we both got the data. So it's not rival. The fact that you're consuming it doesn't impact whether I'm consuming it or not. And then there's a question of whether it's excludable or not. Can I exclude you from accessing the data? Well, it depends on intellectual property law and depends on various policies, but at the very least, we would want to say data is non-rival. So what that means is when you talk about ownership, that's really too narrow of an economic concept to apply to data. You want to think about licensing, you want to think about sharing, you want to think about subscriptions, all sorts of other aspects of ways you might deal with that data as an economic good, so that you have a much broader set of contractual relationships that are possible around data than around something like a private good.
A lot of people talk about a fourth industrial revolution or a second machine age, and basically the idea is that these kinds of technological changes, the ubiquitous data, the digitalization, machine learning, meaningful and powerful AI, that this could drive some kind of surge in productivity growth and maybe in a somewhat explosive kind of way. So are you one of the people that, you know, would you consider yourself one of the people that would be called the techno-optimists, so to speak, or where do you sit on the spectrum?
Well, I would say we certainly hope we'll get some productivity boom out of data, because we could really use a productivity boom. As you know, productivity has been growing remarkably slowly for the last decade or 15 years, and many people think that application of data analytics, of robotics, these could really boost productivity significantly. So I would say that's certainly a possibility. I don't think it's proven yet, but I think that it's something that we could hope would occur, and there's some signs that may actually occur.
And of course, a lot of this goes to how these things are measured, right? And you've been one of the more outspoken people when it comes to talking about what the official GDP and productivity numbers are missing. So could you just share a little bit with us here about what your thinking there is?
Well, I'll give you my favorite example, which is photography. Back in 2000, there were 80 billion photos taken in the world. We know that because there were only three companies that made film, and so we could count it. Those photos cost about 50 cents a piece for the film and developing. Now, fast forward to 2015, and the world changed quite a bit. There are 1.6 trillion photos taken in 2015, according to my estimates, and they cost essentially zero. Now, you might ask, that's a tremendous increase in productivity. Well, maybe to a layperson, but not to an economist, because most of those photos aren't traded in a market. They're shared among friends or viewed by individuals or sent to relatives, all those sorts of things. It's not a market-level transaction. And in fact, when you think about it, they're not selling film anymore. They're not selling developing services. They're not selling cameras anymore. Most of that 1.6 trillion photos were taken off your mobile phone. So the GDP probably went down because all those other things were not being transacted in. And here we have this zero cost, zero price good photos that's being produced by a completely different technology. And you can tell the same story for GPS, for example. Used to be we had these map things made. It was hard enough getting around the using a map, but then when you got around, you had to fold the map back up, and that was a challenge too. But nowadays, we have a much, much simpler, more efficient, better way to navigate than we did then. Also, by the way, probably reduced GDP when mapping software moved onto your mobile phone, because people stopped buying the dedicated GPS systems.
And how much do you think this explains? Like, how much is missing from the data, do you really think? Does this completely change the picture, or is it, not so much?
No, I don't think it completely changes the picture, but it changes the interpretation quite a bit. When people would try to pin me down on that issue, I'll say, well, maybe it's a quarter of the gap between where we'd like to see productivity growth, 2% or so, and where we're actually at, which is about 0.5%. So you might clear a quarter of that difference, but it's not the whole story by any means.
Okay. So I'd like to turn to policy issues now. So there's a lot of talk these days that the big tech firms like Google, Facebook, Amazon, they've basically become too powerful and are basically just massive monopolies with too much influence over both the economy and society more generally. Now, I think a lot of this goes to fairly fundamental issues about how we interact socially and how our democracies even function. But from an economic standpoint, the key issue is about whether or not the big tech firms have excessive market power, whether this is having a negative effect on competition and therefore efficiency and even potentially innovation. And in particular, a lot of people will talk about how when it comes to the tech companies, when it comes to data, you benefit from these kinds of network effects, where the more people use your services, you know, the more dominant you become. So I'm interested just to get your thoughts on this. You know, what kind of effect do you see the tech firms having on competition, and do you think the situation right now is healthy or not?
That was a long question with a lot of parts. But let me start on a few of them. You can remind me if I miss some. One is, when you look at these large companies, what the Europeans refer to as GAFA, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon. Am I forgetting somebody? I don't know. Those are Microsoft is often thrown in there too. When you look at these large tech companies, one thing that's unique about the market structure there is that each of them has a core competency. So Apple makes gadgets, and Google makes searches, and Amazon sells products, etc. But at the same time, they're all competing intensely with each other across those industry boundaries. So look at operating systems. Well, Microsoft has an operating system, Apple has an operating system, Google has an operating system, Amazon has an operating system. Look at office applications or productivity applications. They come from Microsoft, they come from Google, they come from Apple. Look at advertising services. They come from Google, they come from Amazon, they come from Facebook, from Microsoft, and on and on and on. I have a list of about 25 different dimensions in which these companies compete with each other. And it's really an intensely competitive environment. Imagine what life would be like if Amazon only sold books, Google only provided search, Microsoft only did operating systems. So you had these vertical provision of services without any competition across industries. It would be a much worse world. I mean, that would be a world really where there was not much competition. But the world we actually live in, there's a lot of competition because of that. Intense competition across these industry giants. And not only that, if we focus in on just Google, the company that I know best, we're in the search business, but of course our business, where the money comes from, is from advertising. So if you look at the data, about 94% of the clicks are organic clicks. And about 6% of the clicks are ad clicks. So it's that 6% of the clicks that are making all the money that supports the entire enterprise. And furthermore, those commercial clicks, those clicks that are associated with ads, there's a very intensive set of competition there. Not only other general purpose search engines, but all the special purpose search engines. Because if you're going on a trip, you might look at hotels.com or bookings.com or Trivago or tripplanner.com, etc. TripAdvisor.com, sorry. If you're going shopping, you will go to a merchant or a merchant aggregator. Now in the U.S., more than half of all product searches start on Amazon. So they're intensely competing for those clicks as well. You can go find products by going and typing them into Google, or you could go directly to Amazon, or you could go to Walmart or to Target or any other retailer. So you've got a lot of competition for the commercial clerks. There's not much competition for queries about Socrates. Okay, a lot of people search for Socrates. Maybe they're writing a term paper. Maybe they're trying to remember a quote or something. But those organic clicks are not really relevant to the competition issue. It's the commercial clicks that are relevant to competition. Now, I hit a couple of the high points. What did I leave out?
No, I think that's pretty good as an opening bet on competition, but right. And I think those are very interesting points, and they're not points that I think are in the mainstream that people often hear about how there's all this competition across the tech companies. In fact, although when you think about it, it makes a fair bit of sense. But let me raise a few counterpoints as well, and just to get your response quickly. I mean, with each of the big tech firms, there's still a core component which looks a lot like a monopoly, I suppose, or where you have a very dominant position. So Google has search, Amazon has its platform and ebooks, Facebook has social media.
Or you could say it's a core competitive advantage these companies have. Historically, Apple's been very good at design. Historically, Amazon's been very good at logistics, and on and on and on. And the reason they're successful is because they're so good at the specialties that they engage in.
What about the so-called network effects that people talk about?
Yeah.
Do you think that's overplayed, or then is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So let's look at network effects. Back in 1998, which is really ancient history, Carl Shapiro and I wrote a book called Information Rules, and that was the first book to actually introduce the term network effects to a general audience. The term had been used in economics before, but it was not a well-known concept at that time. And we have a very specific meaning for network effects in economics. If the value of the good increases, the more users there are, then we say there's a network effect. So prime example these days is something like Facebook, where you've got a social network. The more people that are involved in that social network, the more attractive it is to potential people joining it. So LinkedIn is another example of this. That's what's called a direct network effect. But then there's an indirect network effect. The canonical example there is looking at an operating system. You're going to choose the operating system where the most applications, and the developers are going to choose to develop where the most users. So you've got increase in A makes it more attractive to B, the increase in B makes it more attractive to A, and again you get this positive feedback loop going. Now if we look at Google, just as a case in point, there's no direct network effect because I don't care what search engine you use. Well, I do care, but you know, not in any significant way. And there's no indirect effect either. So where's the network effect? Some people say, well, there's what they call a data network effect. The more people use your product, the more data you have. The more data you have, the better product you can make. Mm. So there's some truth to that. But that's not unique to technology. That's true to automobiles. That's true for washing machines. That's true for anything. As you sell more of the product, you learn more about what the customers want. You learn how they use their product. You use that information to refine it and make a better product. So that's a good thing to do in general. And it's not just something that shows up in technology. It's what we call in economics learning by doing. The more you produce, the more expertise you acquire. The more expertise you acquire, the better product you can produce. So to me, yes, that's true. That's an economic phenomenon that people are familiar with, the learning curve, etc. But it's nothing new, and it's nothing that's unique to technology industries.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, so particularly out of Europe, there's been a lot more sort of competition, mistrust, antitrust cases, right, being directed towards the big tech companies, including Google.
You mean the big five American companies?
Yes. Right. So I don't want you to talk about in particular cases, but do you think that is that a sign that there is a problem then, or do you think that's something else? In particular, because you know people do expect the big tech firms to grow quite significantly from here and become you know more dominant, more powerful in many ways. And in that case, is it a legitimate fear that these kind of market power abuse type cases would then become more prolific or something along those lines?
Well, Europe has a different philosophy towards antitrust than we have in the U.S. or indeed in Anglo-Saxon law in general. What I would say is in our system, the goal is to preserve competition, whereas the Europeans pay a lot more attention to treatment of competitors. All right. So the basic, simplest, most naive view of antitrust is we want to see a race where the person who runs the fastest wins, but we don't want to see a win because they're tripping their opponents or engaging in some kind of unfair competition that disadvantages the competitors. Did I say components? I meant to say competitors rather than rather than looking at the consumers. So our goal is looking at consumer welfare. We think that consumer welfare is best served by a competition, but the competition has to be fair competition. And in Europe, there's a great deal of emphasis on that issue of how competitors are treated by firms that are competing in their industry. All right, so there's a different philosophy there.
Okay, we're running a little bit out of time, so let me just ask you for some quick responses to a few different policy ideas that people are putting forward, all in some way aimed at either sort of reining in the power of big tech firms or responding to some of the various competition-related issues. But, you know, let's try and move through them relatively quickly. So one idea is the most extreme, which is that the big tech firms should simply just be broken up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you respond to that? I assume you get that every now and then.
Yes, I think that would be counterproductive, yes.
Okay, fair enough. Nothing more on that one? Okay. What about the idea that you should be considered more like social infrastructure or public utility, particularly things like the search function for Google or the repository of people's relationships when it comes to Facebook, these kinds of things? The implication being that then you would be very heavily and tightly regulated, I suppose.
Right. Well, I think it would be naive to think that these tech companies would not be regulated. Indeed, they're currently regulated. Things like GDPR in Europe are affecting the way that we deal with privacy issues. The right to be forgotten, also from Europe, that is a regulation which applies to us and is quite expensive to comply with. So, of course, there will be regulation. I think the important thing is to have efficient regulation that produces meaningful results and isn't just regulation for regulation's sake.
What about data portability requirements? That's part of GDPR, and here in Australia they're talking about a consumer data right to do the same thing. What do you think of the economics of that?
So we feel pretty good about that because it's been consistent with our policy almost since the beginning. We had a program at one time called Data Liberation Front, and that later became Google Takeout. So if you want to take any of your data out from Google, your photos or your mail or your search history or location history or any of those things, it's very easy for you to do. Just go to Google Takeout. You can download it to your disk drive. You can download it to Microsoft One. You can download it to Google Drive, Dropbox, wherever you want. So you have access to all of the data that you've generated. Now, one thing we noticed is we had take out, but there was very little take in. So once you've downloaded all your mail, then what? So recently, in the last month or 6 weeks, we've set up a program called the Data Transfer Project with partners like Facebook and Twitter and a few others, that you can actually move your data from one place to another, again, simply by a few key presses.
Okay, so this is actually will be the last question before I'll open it up to the audience for Q&A, so please be ready with your questions. So here you know that the Australian Competition Authority, the ACCC, is conducting an inquiry into the digital platforms with a specific focus on your impact on the traditional media industry. And this is, of course, not a question that only Australia is looking at. It's a question that many countries around the world are looking at. So I'd like to just get your thoughts on how do you see the digital platforms, Google in particular, but also Facebook is seen as important in this too. How do you think they've really transformed the media industry? And then what does that mean for how governments should think about policy in response?
Well, I would step back a little bit and say it's really how the internet has impacted the news industry, not just these individual companies. Because newspapers never made money from news. They made money from automotive, from home and garden, from travel, from restaurant reviews, from entertainment, all those sections where there were contextually relevant ads that you could show that were related to the material in that section. So if you went to the cooking section with the recipes, there might be ads for kitchen equipment and other things of this sort. That revenue from these commercially relevant areas is what was used to subsidize, cross-subsidize the production of news. Because most news, there's nothing real, there's no commercial ads that are contextually relevant to news. If you go read about the devastation that's going on in Florida, that has gone on in Florida from the hurricane, well, you're not going to be interested in buying cheap flights to Miami, and you're not going to be interested in getting a bed and breakfast in Florida Panhandle or any of these other places. It's just news that's interesting to you because we're human beings and want to know what's happening in other areas and to other people. But now the internet comes along. Well, there's hundreds of sites on cooking and hundreds of sites on automotive and travel and entertainment and all these other things. So that business model of using those commercially relevant topics to cross-subsidize news, that's pretty much gone away. Now, there are some ways that newspapers are responding to this change by changing the kinds of advertisements that they're doing, by trying to move more towards a subscription model and other things of this sort. And we're working closely with many news organizations to try to experiment in different ways to build sustainable funding models for newspapers.
Okay, we'll open it up now to Q&A from the audience. So the usual rules, please state your name, affiliation, and also stick to a question. So,
Marius, I'm a graduate of the University of Wollongong. And I'm interested in how China's, places like, countries like China and North Korea, they're very sort of strict policies on social media and Google, Facebook, whatnot. How does that affect your economic analysis? And given that they are in place, are you able to use, conduct any analysis on the Chinese or Korean equivalents of what we've talked about? Given that China's set to be such a, you know, like such a massive economy and the number of people there.
Right. Well, the internet architecture in China is unique in the world. There are only about 5 entry points into China, whereas in most countries there are dozens, if not hundreds, of entry points. And so they have strictly managed their internet access there because they view it as a potentially destabilizing influence. I have no idea about North Korea. I assume that the internet access in North Korea is very highly controlled. But of course, within China, there is a search engine, Baidu, that's widely used because people still have the same need to find information. And actually, China is progressing very rapidly in applying internet, machine learning, artificial intelligence, robotics to various aspects of their economy. And in fact, it's imperative that China do this because China has a terrible demographic overhang from the one-child policy. So if you look at what China will look like in 20 years, there's going to be a lot of retired non-working people and a relatively small segment of working people. And those working people have to be substantially more productive if they can produce the output that's necessary to provide consumption and food and care for all those non-working people. And of course, this is true in many countries in the developed world. Japan is in the middle of this now. We've got Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, Germany, Italy, Spain, and by the way, U.S. and Australia, not nearly as bad as those examples in terms of the demography, but we're going to face the same challenges. It's important that we become more productive in order to provide a standard of living that's consistent for all the people that are going to be around in another 10 or 20 years.
So just quickly on picking up on that, on U.S.-China, how important is technological competition between these two countries? As from an economic standpoint, is this something that matters, or is this more a political issue?
Right. Well, I think it's very hard to keep the cat in the bag on technology because in many cases, once you know something is possible, you can usually make it work. So many, many cases, let's take artificial intelligence and image recognition, Once people find out that deep neural nets are a good way to handle image recognition, you're going to see a lot of work on deep neural nets, as we've seen, and you're going to see a lot of progress in that area. So it may well be that China will be conducting a lot of work in AI and robotics, but I don't see how they can really keep the rest of the world away from the fruits of that work.
Yeah, it's a diffusion story, basically.
It's diffusion, and, you know, started, when was it, 1400, that the monks with the hollow staffs walked out of China with silkworms in their walking sticks. So there's been technology transfer going on for several centuries.
Audrey Lorber-Pula from the Treasury. Lovely to have you here, Professor Varian.
Thank you for
joining us. I have a question regarding the role of government in a big data world. 10 to 20 years ago, government pretty much had a monopoly on the data we collect on our citizens. And with the increased collection of Google data, I imagine some of the data you have would have very interesting policy insights and implications for society at large. What role do you see government playing in that relationship with large tech firms like Google, Facebook, and how can that partnership be used for the betterment of society?
Mm-hmm. That's really an excellent question, and I have worked in that area of talking with government agencies, statistical agencies, about how we might contribute to their mission. So let me give you a couple examples. One simple one is what we call initial claims for unemployment benefits. So when you become unemployed, you go down to the unemployment office and fill out some forms, and then you get these benefits. But if you became unemployed, what's the first thing you might do? You might go to Google and say, where's the unemployment office? What are the hours of the unemployment office? What do I need to take to apply for these benefits, et cetera, et cetera? So if you look for queries that have that form, it turns out, yes, indeed, they are highly predictive of people who actually go to the office to file for unemployment benefits. And if you step back a little bit and look at the broader macroeconomy, one thing we've found, and I think many other macroeconomists are aware of this, is that if you look at things like going out to eat, queries related to dining and entertainment, those are very closely associated with consumer sentiment. And when people stop going out to eat, then you know they're feeling pretty squeezed. Same thing with vacations. If you look at vacation planning, what happens there is when times are flush, they're going out on long luxury vacations, and when times are tight, they're staying home. Now, we saw this during Arab Spring. Remember Arab Spring? One of the important lessons there is if you want to attract tourists in your country, don't have riots, because the riots definitely turned the tourism off. When there were riots in Egypt, people just stopped going to Egypt, and it was 12%. Tourism was 12% of the Egyptian economy, so that was really a big hit. Same thing with Turkey, same thing with Greece, same thing with North Africa. What benefited from those riots were, in fact, Spain, Portugal, Italy, places where people felt their vacation would be ruined by some kind of political discourse. So there's lots of things you can learn by looking at these queries about people's expectations or plans and so on. One other interesting area is to look at inflation. There's a project at MIT called the Billion Prices Project where they're scraping price data. Another interesting thing is to look at hedonic adjustments for consumer goods, where you're looking at quality changes and how prices relate to those quality changes. There's lots of places where they're really, I think, it's quite useful to use Google data and related data for addressing these kinds of problems.
Hi, good day, Peter Green. It's an AI question, and I'll start by saying who we are is usually not as good as who we want to be, and I think we teach AI with data sets. So do we curate the data sets to make AI who we want it to be? And if so, What can you tell us about it?
So are you referring to issues of bias in AI, or?
You don't want your kid to grow up watching junk food ads and eating badly. So when you go to AI, you want to teach it things which have good outcomes.
Ah, I see. Okay, right. Well, I once said that what we should do with robots is make sure that robots think we're cute, just like we think puppies and kitties are cute, so we take care of them. And if the robots think we're cute, then that would be a good thing. But to answer your question more seriously, I think that, you want to try to use the artificial intelligence in ways that are socially beneficial. But it's also equally true that not everybody is going to do that. So we have to think about defensive measures as well as just our own behavior. So people, for example, there's a lot of debate about facial recognition. Well, facial recognition is a great thing when you're looking through your photo album to try to find a picture of your kid at age 7. But that it could be a worrisome thing when people are using it for surveillance and tracking behavior. Now, all technology is like that. Fire can be good for warming the cave, and it could be bad for burning down forests. And we just have to try to think about how to use these technologies in socially beneficial ways, but also think about how we can defend ourselves against misuse of the technology.
Hello, my name's Zainab. I'm an undergrad student from Macquarie University. And my question is, what affiliation do Google and Facebook have in terms of the data they collect on people for displaying ads? Because it so happens that, you know, when you type something onto, let's say, Google, a while later it shows onto Facebook. And then with regard to that affiliation, how much revenue does that generate for both the parties?
So Google doesn't have any specific relationship with Facebook. Typically, there would be a merchant. The merchant might advertise on both Google and Facebook, and they might set a cookie that says, the next time you see this person, show them this reminder ad. And it could be that that could easily show up on Facebook. So you go to Google, you browse on Google, you click on Google, you go to the merchant site, the merchant says, set a cookie, and then the next time you go to Facebook, you're going to see the ad for that product on Facebook. But there's no connection between Google and Facebook. It's all passing through the merchant. And the merchant wants to advertise wherever it's going to be most effective to them, which might be in Facebook or might be somewhere else.
Thank you for the talk thus far, Professor. This is Dominic from the Reserve Bank of Australia, Dominic Jones. You highlight the importance of analytics, statistics in refining data. And this is a bit different to the use of statistics as we know it now. It's kind of becoming this highly automated organ of the modern economy as opposed to just scientific papers and that sort of thing. But statistics was never designed to be secure, see adversarial machine learning, where malicious actors attack directly the data or the statistical models. Rendering them either useless or potentially dangerous. Have you or Google thought about the economic risks here, both to the firms that depend on these data network effects and the macroeconomy generally?
Yeah, so we're absolutely thinking about adversarial AI because that's a very important concept. And it has both a plus and a minus. So the plus is maybe you've heard about AlphaGo Zero, where we taught a computer the rules of chess, and then we set two programs to play chess against each other and learn what good moves are. And after 2 days of running, they were able to beat the best chess player in the world, which was also a computer program. So there was a case where you had to know, you didn't have to know anything. You just had to have a way to keep score, and you could use this adversarial algorithms to improve the chess game significantly. And that's true with almost any kind of game as well. But at the same time, the interesting thing about adversarial AI on the negative side is that we have discovered that computers are subject to optical illusions, just like humans are subject to optical illusions, but they're completely different optical illusions. So a human, you know, I'm sure we've all seen this, which line is longer? Well, you can be fooled by this kind of optical illusion, but the optical illusion that the computer sees may have no relationship at all to what a human sees. Because when you're training systems, they may pick up on aspects of the system that are not important to humans, but could be very helpful in identifying the objects from the viewpoint of computers. So one example is guns. You know, if you look at gunmetal, it has a certain reflection that you might be able to recognize. But that reflection is a factor, or a feature, I should say, that's important in terms of the computer recognizing guns. And so you can fool the computer into thinking it's a gun when really it's just a particular kind of reflection. So we have, if you go to Google's research site, we have several papers on this adversarial AI, and it's something that people are quite focused on in trying to understand how it works, what its limitations are, how it can be used for good purposes like training, and how it might be used for threatening purposes.
It's Ganesh Prasad, CTO of Bion Platform, a media trading platform. So my question is about, there's been a lot of talk about the technology singularity, where artificial intelligence finally surpasses the human mind. There's also a lesser known element called the energy singularity, where the marginal cost of energy is going to be almost zero. Hmm. And since everything achieved in the human history has been as a result of energy being applied by intelligence, with artificial intelligence driving or directing new initiatives and cheap or free energy powering it, what do you think the future of human society is going to look like?
Well, that's a pretty broad question, too. I have to say, I haven't really thought about that very much. I'm somewhat skeptical about both singularities, both the intelligence singularity and the energy singularity, but it would be great if we were able to produce clean, efficient energy in vast amounts. The world would be completely different if that happens, because you'd be able to engage in all sorts of activities that are just prohibitively costly now. So I don't really have a vision of what that world would look like.
What about the related question about the fears of automation, yeah, or that technology in a somewhat milder sense, instead of unemployment, it's more widening inequality? What's your view on that quickly?
Well, there's unemployment and there's leisure. And what exactly is the difference? One is involuntary and one is voluntary. When you look around the world, I did this recently at work weeks. You might think about what country has the shortest work week in the world. And the answer, somewhat surprisingly, is the Netherlands, 29 hours a week. Full day, less than a 40-hour week, right? But the reason is not because they do anything particularly magical. It's just that they've set up social policies that encourage and enable part-time work. And people sometimes want to say, I'd like to work a three-day work week, or I'd like to work even maybe a two-day work week. I think in the future we're going to see much more flexible labor arrangements where people can choose 40-hour weeks, 50-hour weeks, or 20-hour weeks. It's up to them. And even now we see that it's possible to subsist, at least in developed countries, on relatively short work weeks, Netherlands being a case in point.
What about the inequality question, though, then?
Well, often it's an issue of looking at the family. So in this particular case, one of the reasons they implemented these flexible hours is because it was much better for families to be able to deal with childcare and with domestic activities and labor market activities. So over the right thing to look at is not individual inequality, is to look at the household inequality. And there's substantially less household inequality because they can adjust the income to what their needs are like at this particular point in time in a more flexible way than you could if everybody just had 40-hour work weeks.
It's probably a lot within the inequality sphere we could talk about, but let's get another question down here.
Hi, my name is Rose. I'm from Energy Consumers Australia. Mm-hmm. As you know, electricity prices have more than doubled over the past couple of years, and consumers are telling us that they need to be able to access their consumption data so that they can consequently reduce their bills. But the problem is where this data should be stored. Does it sit with the retailer or the market body or the operator or any third party? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I did know that electricity prices had doubled in the last few years. In the U.S., we're running into some problems where there's so much renewable energy being produced now that it's become something of a burden on the traditional ways of generating electricity because, of course, you have to have the capacity to deal with the cloudy days or the windless days in order to provide electricity service when the renewables aren't there. In general, if the question is which is the most secure place to put the data, I would look into cloud computing facilities because they put a huge emphasis on making data access highly secure. But I'm sure it could be handled by the electricity utility companies as well. It's just who has the expertise that's going to be necessary to create a secure repository for that data. And you will run up against this problem of security versus ease of use. If you want something to really be secure, that means it's going to be difficult to access, not just by the bad guys, but even by you. And if you want consumers to find it easy to access that data, then it's probably going to end up being somewhat insecure. So you have to think about what the risks are associated with those two different approaches.
Okay, a question on this side.
I'm Robert Grundy. I have no affiliations. I'm simply retired. An operation like Google requires not only massive amounts of power and a network of facilities. It also draws very heavily on things like water for cooling purposes. Do you think there are any practical limitations to the growth of facilities like Google in terms of engineering size and efficiency?
It's a good question. We're actually carbon neutral now. We've invested very heavily in wind generation. So we are producing clean energy that's equal to the energy that we utilize in our data centers. We've looked at this cooling business. One of our recent plants was built in Finland using a structure from an old sawmill, a lumber processing plant, and there we were using seawater to cool the system, and that seems to work out pretty well. A lot of our data centers are actually air-cooled, not water-cooled, and the waste energy, or let's say the heat dissipation properties of those data centers has been very, very highly optimized. So it's important to remember that if the weather is bad for humans, it's good for data centers. So if you look in Europe, we have data centers in Finland, we have them in Ireland, we have them in Belgium, and other countries that are not known for their beautiful climates. Now, I don't think that's going to prevent us from having a data center in Australia at some point, but just how that works, I don't know. I don't think there are really physical limitations on data centers that are significant, because you can put them in lots of different places, you can use lots of different technology for cooling them, and you can use lots of renewable energy as well.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your insightful comments on all those questions that you get. My name is Farouk van Beuningen. I am from the Netherlands, working as Consul General here in Sydney. I don't know whether there's a relationship, but it may be of interest that the Netherlands also ranks very high in the happiest people of the world. Who knows? My question is
even,
about a
even
complete...
more happy than Sydney ciders. I thought might...
Well, I'm not sure, but we're pretty high there yeah. in that ranking. My question is on a completely different subject. Once, also here in Sydney, I was at a lecture about blockchain technology, and the person who presented that was predicting a kind of a revolution in the way that economic transactions would take place in the future. Now, I'm always getting a bit hesitant when people talk about a revolution, but anyway, I would like to hear your comments on that type of technology. Thank you.
So I think that cryptography in various forms is going to play a significant role in our financial institutions for all the reasons we just discussed. The security, of course, is an important issue, and we need to be able to develop secure systems, and that's going to involve cryptography in one form or another. Whether we have cryptocurrencies, I have to say I'm quite skeptical on that point. I'll believe in a cryptocurrency when you can use it to pay your taxes. And at least right now, so far as I know, you can't pay your taxes in cryptocurrency. You have to use Australian dollars or U.S. dollars or whatever is relevant for your particular jurisdiction.
You may not have a very high income.
Hmm?
You may not have a very high taxable or tax-reported income if you're earning cryptocurrency, perhaps.
maybe, or at least a very volatile one. On the other hand, there are some very interesting ideas in this area. One that I particularly like is the idea of smart contracts, where you and I can make an agreement that's then encoded into a bit of computer instructions, which are then implemented if certain conditions occur, and you can automate certain kinds of transactions by doing that. So let me give you an example. I'm going to go back to Google now. Used to be the old model for advertising was I'm going to show an ad impression, you pay me, and maybe people will see that ad impression and go to your store. That was basic model for advertising. Now, what happens is, I'm going to show you an ad impression. You only have to pay me if people click on that ad and go to your store. Okay? So it's a much nicer model from the viewpoint of the advertiser because it has this accountability in there. But we're able to do that kind of contract because you've got both parties observing, yes, indeed, the person clicked on that ad. Yes, indeed, they showed up at the website. It's the same person who clicked on the ad and who then subsequently appeared on the website. So when you have more things that are observable, more things you can observe because of the computerization of the transaction, then that allows you to make more flexible contracts that can help improve the efficiency of the economic transactions.
I think we have time for just one last, lucky last question. Maybe we'll go to Alex at the back.
Hi, I'm Alex from the Loo Institute. I'm not from the Netherlands, but I do work part-time, and I must say it's great. So I have a question. Yeah, tonight we talked about the fact that technology does rise productivity, but also it rises the level of inequalities in the countries that do benefit this technology. I wanted to know what was the role of the company, the GAFAM, you call them, companies?
GAFAM.
GAFAM. So Google, Apple, Facebook. What is the role that these companies have to solve this issue?
On inequality in particular. Okay, I don't think that technology necessarily has to increase inequality. And in fact, there are cases where it works exactly the opposite. So think about Henry Ford and the Model T. Before the Model T, cars were just toys for rich people. And then along comes the Model T, and it becomes something that's affordable to anybody. The original price in 1909 was $750, but within 3 years, it had fallen virtually in half. And most of the population could afford to buy a car. Now, I don't understand why people don't think that people could afford to buy a robot, for example. If you can produce a car for $350 in 1909, why can you produce a really inexpensive robot? Same thing with mobile phones. Mobile phones were toys for rich people. Only people who made a lot of money could afford to pay enough to get a mobile phone. But now everybody has a mobile phone. So there's a lot of technology that is valuable and useful to people, and competition and productivity improvements are going to push the prices down, and that's a factor that's important in decreasing inequality. So I don't think there's a necessary connection there between inequality and technology. I think it could go either way.
Of course, this effect is something that has become known as the so-called Varian rule, that you look at what the rich people have, and then it eventually flows through to everyone else.
Yep.
So
yep.
Some critical thinking right there. So I think that's all the time we have this evening. So can everyone just join me in thanking Professor Varian for a very interesting talk.